It's great to be back. I'm Ian Jones, a lawyer, doesn't make me a bad person, from Backhouse Jones. And it's great to be back in London and back on air with The Backview. Cast your mind back to 1981, when Steven Spielberg offered us James Bond without the hardware, in the form of Dr. Henry Jones, a professor of archaeology. I would like to have been in that meeting when someone pitched that idea. A professor looking at ancient dusty artifacts that should be in a museum. Spielberg named his fictional professor Indiana, and he encountered many important figures in history, and in the Temple of Doom, he stumbled across a secret cult in the catacombs of an ancient palace. This ITT podcast deals with innovation in technology and transport, with a side order of law, and my next guest knows little of transport, but knows plenty about innovation, and a side order of law will become the main dish of the day. Today, I have back on air Professor Dominic Regan, who is an honest-to-goodness professor of law, and can even make the driest of legal lectures with his brisk editing into a light and suspenseful search for the Holy Grail. He is as effervescent and dashing as his archaeological counterpart, and I'm wondering if he will offer an opinion today on whether the legal profession is a dusty, secret cult, fearful of innovation and technology. Dom, welcome to The Backview.
Well, thank you. That's a very, very generous, effusive introduction, but I'm looking forward to a good natter.
I think the problem is we've only got half an hour, and you and I can talk for hours, as we have done for many years, and I've known you 25 years.
Oh, I know.
I read just the other day an article by John Backhouse, the twins' father, which he wrote in 1992, giving a prognosis for the future of the legal profession. And he predicted lawyers working from home and engaging with people on the computer. And this is back in 1992. He did also get it wrong about helipads on the top of court buildings and air taxis. But how do you think the legal profession is innovating at the moment?
Lawyers historically have had this ghastly reputation for, you know, being Luddites and doing things in the old-fashioned way. One piece of technology that I think lawyers actually embraced very quickly was the fax machine and, you know, sort of transmitting documents. And that actually accelerated the whole of law, because in the old days, as we might recall, you know, you'd receive a letter, you'd need to reply to the letter. So what you would do, you'd dictate using a dictating machine. Partners would have a secretary to do it in shorthand. You dictate the letter, it would go away, it'd be typed up, it would come back to you a day later. You might well refine it, adjust it. It's always a sensible thing to, certainly for lawyers, to think twice before they fire off hot words. And by the time that the reply was dispatched, we could be 3 or 4 days down the line. Then, of course, with the fax machine, suddenly, it's like lawyers are on sort of some drug. It's like a game of table tennis, and the correspondence is flying backwards and forwards, and we have exchanges, you know, within minutes or within hours. I cite that example because I thought it was a good example of how technology was embraced, and it was embraced by lawyers. I mean, pathetically, even as we speak today in 2020, you don't have the right to serve court proceedings on an opponent by fax. You need their consent. So that is a lag, and that is something that is long, long overdue. But I do think that lawyers have moved on. Back in 2010, I was asked to help a legal legend called Sir Rupert Jackson with overhauling litigation, civil litigation, and I got paid an enormous amount for that. Nothing. And I only did 9 years, so that was all right. And Rupert Jackson, a brilliant character, really hard-working man, and he said, Dominic, it's like Victorian times, you know, the bills are drawn up. In fact, a wonderful point made by the current Master of the Rolls is this: if you were to drop a lawyer from sort of Dickensian times, if you were to parachute them into a court today, you know, they'd still pretty much know what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, standing up, my lord, examination, cross-examination.
They'd be dressed for the occasion.
They'd be dressed for the occasion. And I thought that was a really telling insight from Sir Terence Etherton, that, you know, things need to change. And Rupert Jackson said, it's all the paper has got to go, it's got to be paperless, it's got to be electronic, and we are moving in that direction. Yeah.
And do you think that law firms are becoming paperless?
Yes, they are. They are, because of cost efficiency. Although I'm such an old-fashioned lawyer that I can read anything anywhere and do, but if I really want to digest a judgment, I've got to read it off paper, and then I can doodle all over it. I can highlight it. And pathetically, I have my pens, and I've got a green for this and a red for that, and that way I just absorb it. And it sticks in my head.
Yeah. I remember when laptops came in, and the first time I saw a judge with a laptop rather than a Mont Blanc pen, it was worthy of comment just because you could hear the click, click, click as the witness was giving the evidence.
Yeah.
And I think lawyers have got this bad reputation for trying to increase costs, but the reality is most of them want to reduce it to make it more efficient.
Of course they do. Your laptop scenario is brilliant. And I say that because 5 minutes walk from where we're sitting is the Supreme Court. And whenever I can, I mean, obviously, current circumstances are difficult, but if I'm in London and I've got half an hour, I will drop in and I will listen. Because my top tip for lawyers is, whenever you can, sit in court. You listen and you learn, and I've never stopped learning. But I mentioned the Supreme Court because the last time I was there, there were maybe three of them were using laptops, and four of them, it was an unusual seven rather than a five-member bench, and four of them were using either biros or fountain pen. So we're still in a stage of transition. But of course, to be in the Supreme, you're not going to get in the Supreme Court unless you're, you know, of a certain vintage. And the younger guys and ladies, I hasten to add, the profession, they are really now tech savvy. In fact, the last time I was in the Supreme Court, counsel said, I refer to MS-12, and I thought that was manuscript, and it wasn't. It was memory stick. So they are definitely, tech is...
Are you seeing artificial intelligence coming into the legal profession?
No. Honest to God, no. And what I see is tech porting. The best example, and because the rules quite recently about electronic disclosure and using technology to deal with the management of documents, because litigation is all about documents. Okay, and so 1st of January 2019, we had a pilot scheme introduced. I mean, this is not new. Back in 2008, we had a case called Digicel, which is a great case. In Digicel, it was all about using technology to read the documents, so-called, and this is keyword searching. And it was hilarious because this is all about alleged fraud. And so they used sort of words to cover things up. So Irish friends was one of the phrases used in the documents, which we actually meant to the competitor. But it was all about using technology, scanning all the documents, feeding in the keywords, right? What documents that we want to see would likely contain words like, you know, damage, breach of contract. And so the software would read all the documents at the speed of light and pull out every document containing a keyword. So that was the first part of it. Then we moved on to something called predictive coding, which is now of the moment and indeed mentioned in the ongoing pilot scheme that started in 2019. And this is more sophisticated. So predictive coding, so all the documents are scanned, and in heavy litigation we'd have millions of documents. And we then take out a sample of those documents and we mark them either one, yep, they're on the money, they're relevant, zero, they're not. And that information is then fed back into the software. And so what we are doing, we're tutoring the software to think as we think. This is what I want to see. This isn't going to be do me any favor. I don't need that. And that is used now to accelerate the management of documentation. And indeed, in the rules about the pilot scheme on disclosure in the business and property courts, there is a specific directive that if there are 50,000 or more documents, then really the court's going to say to you, if you're not doing it, why the hell aren't you using technology? So we are definitely seeing tech coming in, but I see it as a support. I know judges, as a judge, Mr. Justice Stewart, and before the hearing even starts, he's got a template. This action was issued on this date. The grounds of the claim are X, Y, Z. And then he just fills it in as he goes along, because judges are supposed to get judgments delivered in good time. And of course, the nightmare is putting it off, like, you know, not doing your homework at school. And so with that, judges are now using tech so they can deal with things much more quickly.
Lady Hale, who retired as the head of the Supreme Court in January, I think she's written just last week saying about she fears for many of the impositions that have been brought in by lockdown, that they've supplanted the judicial process. Now, we've got a backlog. There's a heavy backlog of cases, and we need Nightingale courts as well as Nightingale hospitals. Do you see technology dealing with trials? Do we have cross-examination by Zoom? Do you think that's even possible?
It depends. That's a lawyer's answer. But there are some cases, if it's an issue about a guarantee or something, or the wording of a document, then it's really just scrutiny and you don't need it. Whereas if it's something fundamental about credibility, allegations of fraud, or underhand conduct, I think there is nothing like seeing the eyes of the witness. And judges absolutely do. But I'll give you an example. Mrs. Justice Yip, Amanda Yip, who was a silk in Manchester before going on the bench, she gave a judgment, certainly in the last couple of years, and she picked up on a witness who wasn't even in the witness box, but how they were reacting to the evidence being given at trial. And I think that is still a massively important thing, because we're talking about people, and people can say one thing and mean another. People can glibly lie through their teeth. It does happen, of course it does, and we'd be idiots to think otherwise. So picking up on those nuances and how they react and what they say, what they don't say, anything like that, the idea that we can just go online is, for me, utter tosh.
Yes, I agree, because when you're buying a lawyer, you're paying for the judgment. Is it judgment? Yes. And in terms of counsel at trial, what do they say? A good barrister won't win you a case, but a bad barrister can lose you a case.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, I do. And of course, I mean, another point, again, on tech, I was taught by the most amazing litigator I ever met in my life, a guy called Phil King at Thompson's. And Phil said to me, your role, it's a great thing about the relationship between you and the barrister, your role is to manufacture the ammunition, and you hand it to the barrister, and they aim at the brains of their opponent. And that's exactly right, and that's what solicitors are all about. It's marshalling the material, gathering the documents, and the barrister, you're giving them that, and a good barrister would do a fine job, but it's all about using that and making it effective.
One of the phrases I hate most is when people say, it's easy, you just. Because whatever comes after the word just is usually rubbish. Because life is more complex than that, and the legal process is more complex. Yeah. You've only got to unfurl a newspaper or click on Twitter, and you'll see people commenting about the legal profession when they really don't know what was going on and what the background was to the case.
Sure.
Or whether there was some circumstances that are not brought out in 140 characters. Do you think that the legal profession is useless at marketing?
An example just roared into my mind there, a case called Darnley and Croydon, which ended up in the Supreme Court. And it just shows how the pendulum can swing. A very simple story. Poor Mr. Darnley, somebody whacked him on the back of the head with a brick. Okay, so he goes to hospital, and the receptionists were more worried about how he got hit. Oh, he's a troublemaker, or he's in a gang or something. They tell him it's going to be 4 hours before somebody can see you. So he goes home and has a massive brain bleed at home and suffers very serious injury. He brings the claim against the hospital. Court of Appeal throw him out, say, well, you can't blame the receptionists. Goes to the Supreme Court, who say, oh, yes, you can. He's entitled to rely on what they said. And any reasonable person told, it's going to be 4 hours, you can see why they'd go away. And in fact, the receptionists were wrong. There was a triage system in place, and he would have been seen within 20 minutes. One instance, you think, oh, that's nonsense. How on earth can the receptionist be liable for such a massive consequence? Supreme Court say, but they were, as day follows night. They got it wrong. If he'd stayed at hospital, then he'd been on the spot. They could have treated him straight away. He'd been okay. That's just a random example of how the pendulum swings in terms of law. In terms of marketing, the worst thing in the world, and I'm afraid many solicitors do this, is say, we've been in practice since 1873. Been a lot of water under the bridge since then. Probably the boys who were around, because they probably were boys in 1873, probably still aren't around now. And it's much more about what we do. I think major things are, when we can see you, accessibility, our experience, and what we charge. And to this day, there are lawyers who are absolutely smoke and mirrors when it comes to charging. And there are cases, because I'm special advisor to the Association of Cost Lawyers in this country, where solicitors just don't tell the client and then dump this massive bill on them at the end. And that's just bad, bad business practice.
What do the judges say about that practice?
They say it's outrageous and they knock bills down. There's a case certainly in the last, 18 months, where Master Leonard held that a bill for 96,000 should be slightly reduced to 15,000, and that included the VAT. Yeah. Right. So they didn't even get the VAT, sorry, for our foreign audience, value added tax. So that was another 20% off that. And it's all because they just took some money up front on account. They didn't keep the client up to date. And I appreciate what you do is dependent upon. If the client wants to be told every day what's going on, then there is an added burden and that's a cost. And it goes on the bill. You know, you get what you pay for. It's the difference between going to McDonald's and going to, you know, to the Ritz and starting with some 1961 Mouton Rothschild Bordeaux. There is a difference in what you get dependent on what you pay. And it's all about, I think, setting out the ground rules at the beginning, agreeing with the client what you're doing. If there are unexpected developments, tell the client and give them the option of determining where they want to go.
Where do you think that cost will go in the legal profession going forward? Do you think that the subscription schemes will take off?
Certainly between such an own client, I think there's a lot to be said for that. In Germany, going back to the Jackson reforms, lots of people have so-called before the event insurance in Germany, so they are insured so to cover them if they do get, unfortunately, dragged into litigation. The last big project I worked for Sir Rupert Jackson, and he reported back in 2017, was to bring in more fixed costs in cases worth up to £100,000. The MOJ tell me, Ministry of Justice, tell me they are very keen to implement this, but they've not done it as yet. It is definitely going to come, and I think then down the line, we'll see fixed costs. This is between the opposing parties go up to claims worth £250,000. Now, I emphasise, because in the British model, the winner gets costs out of the loser. So that's what these fixed costs are about. But of course, if the solicitor is having to do a lot of work, the fixed cost is not going to meet the bill. And so the fixed cost will be but a contribution to the costs incurred. And so naturally, you'll say to the client, well, look, we'll do it for you, but you realise you're going to have to pay us X pounds or euros or dollar, whatever, on top as well.
What do you think? Where does the British legal system stand in your ranking between America, Germany, France? Where are we? Are we good? Are we indifferent?
I think it's brilliant. So the proof of the pudding is that Russians, people, plutocrats, billionaires, where do they come if they got a dispute that can be litigated in this jurisdiction? They come here. There's no bribery. We've got a fabulous range of legal talent. Our solicitors, our barristers, the Rolls building is where we're making up big business commercial claims are heard. We're awaiting the judgment in the autonomy litigation between Hewlett Packard. $1 billion claims, where are they heard? Here, because they know that they'll get a fabulous, fabulous service. And I mean, I'm incredibly proud of our legal system. It is by no means perfect. At the district judges, these are people who deal with everyday litigation. They are really hardworking. They are dedicated. What drives me bananas is that we still have this sort of talented amateur approach whereby, say, a lawyer with a background. There's a true story. A friend of mine who's a leading employment QC has been appointed a circuit judge. And they said, right, what do you want to do? And he said, right, one, I'll do civil work. Two, I'll do crime. They gave him family law. And he rang up and said, you've made a mistake. And they said, no, we haven't. My analogy is this. Imagine you ring up the doctor for an appointment and they say, I'm sorry, the books are full. We haven't got a doctor. We've got this fabulous vet who can see you. And you think, I don't want that. I want somebody who understands my area. And that, I think, is absolutely taboo. And these people, with the best will in the world, are misguided, individuals, and they get it wrong, and then there is an appeal, and the appeal costs money, and it just betrays the system.
There's so many variations within the legal profession. You've got people earning £1,000 an hour. You've probably got lawyers who are earning £1,000 a month, if that. Yeah. People working pro bono or working for nothing. The legal aid system, I think the legal aid system in this country costs 9 pence per person per day. Yeah. But if you listen to the Daily Mail, It's like these fat cat lawyers. People don't understand the importance of the legal profession until it's gone. I think Geoffrey Cox was only saying last week that he would, I think he was quoting Shakespeare, saying he would give the benefit of the doubt to the devil, because without the legal system, you wouldn't be able to stand up to the devil. Yeah. He was more articulate than that. But do you think that the legal profession is the bulwark for democracy? And do you think the legal profession is so important to the country and doing itself a disservice by not getting that across? And we refer to marketing.
Because it was in Shakespeare who wrote the line, first kill all the lawyers. Don't lose that one. Sorry.
Let's not quote Shakespeare anymore.
Okay, right. Let's move on to the Bunty Annual. I think lawyers are absolutely essential for holding people to account, whether it's government, whether it's local authorities, whether it's companies that are abusing their position, whether it's just rich individuals trying to overwhelm the little person. Absolutely. I fear I may be out on a limb here. There's this great fashion in our jurisdiction in the last 20 years. Every barrister I can think of now says, I'm a human rights lawyer. Yeah, you know. Now, can I just point out, because I think this is a massive misrepresentation, that, you know, we had human rights before we had the Human Rights Act. And there's this concept when I was a student called natural justice. And that, you know what, that really was a brilliant thing. You know, you're entitled to a fair hearing and, you know, decisions of local authorities to, you know, confiscate property could be challenged. And there's this, everybody got on this bandwagon and saying, I'm a human rights lawyer, as if we were pre that, we were primitives, and it was, you know, trial by torture or something like that. And I appreciate human rights. I fear I may be slightly in step for the first time in my life with the Daily Mail by saying that some human rights arguments can potentially be overdone. But I'm not for a moment denigrating the system, and I emphasise that. I did a talk at the Law Society with the then president of the Law Society alongside me, and she was a senior partner in a big city firm. And she was saying to these newly qualified people, she's saying, who's interested in human rights? You should all be interested in human rights. And I controversially followed her straight on. I said, well, you know what? Human rights, the argument might be about a gas bill or somebody's electricity being disconnected. Don't sort of go off in this fashionable direction. You know what? Human rights is all well and good, but there is real law out there. There's employment rights, there's discrimination rights, and these are rights. In fact, I'm not boasting, but I had a letter published in the Times about all this stuff, because somebody had said that with Britain leaving Europe, that all these, you know, ghastly employment law rights, troublesome employment law rights, would be swept away. And I pointed out gently that redundancy rights, protection from losing your job, was created by a Labour government, and unfair dismissal was created by a Conservative government, and both were created before we even joined the European Union. And again, there is so much misrepresentation, and it's very glib to say, oh, it's Europe, it's foreigners, it's... and this sort of xenophobia. But you know what? I'm a great believer in what I call the English, because that's what I grew up and trained on, the English legal system. And I'm very proud of it, and I think it's done a lot of good over the years.
I absolutely agree. And I'm going to ask you about capital punishment, but I'm going to sort of dress it up as this. A friend of mine, it was a barrister, and he was once at one of these dinners, and he was sat next to a really old barrister who tried a capital case, and the defendant was found guilty and hung. And so my friend, who was a relatively naive and young, wet behind the ears barrister, said to the said barrister, "And what did you think when they hung him?" and without even putting down his knife and forks, and well, they didn't put the rope round my neck.
So, oh my God!
What's your view on capital punishment? And then one of my favourite films is 12 Angry Men with Henry Fonda, where they deal with the nuances of a capital case. So, what do you think of capital punishment?
Oh, right, okay. Well, again, can I just chuck in? And this is all my stories are true. If the asking afterwards, you know, I'm legit here. Great friend of mine sat, his partner, a man called Lord Bridge, who was involved in the Birmingham IRA bombing trials. And my friend was asking him about that. And he said, well, you know, what was the evidence? Bit? And Lord Bridge said to him, he said, ah, but you should have seen the evidence that wasn't admitted. And so the judge had plainly allowed himself to be coloured by material which should not have been, whether it's obtained by torture or fraud or whatever. But that is an issue. And the trouble with capital punishment is that, you know, you can't undo your mistakes. And over again, I mean, don't get me wrong, I would have rapists locked up for life. I'd have murderers locked up for life. But the nightmare is killing the innocent, and it can happen. And we, over the years, we've had, I mean, equally there have been people who've gone to the gallows. So there's a legendary case called Hanratty, and in the end it transpired he was they exhumed the body, modern science showed that he was the killer, even though everybody's saying, oh, it's a travesty. But the problem is you can't undo the mistakes. And so rather lock somebody up for 30 years, realise your error, and let them out rather than kill them. That's a simplistic approach.
But I think it was just last month. I think even in America, they released a man from death row after 35 years.
Yes, yeah.
Because the DNA evidence produced showed that he could not have done it. So they released him. Many lawyers don't agree with capital punishment, not out of some religious conviction, but more that we see the mistakes that can take place.
And you can get witnesses. We've had lots of cases where so-called experts are subsequently revealed to be lacking in expertise. They make up qualifications. People listen to them. They've got letters after the name, which, you know, they might have bought online. In England, there's a woman called Dr. Gillian McKeith, a great, who sort of starred on television as a sort of medical sort of supremo, or Dr. McKeith, or to give her a full title, Gillian McKeith, because she bought the qualification online from, I think, a Texan university. There's a case in the High Court in 2010 where a witness, party to the litigation, claimed to have acquired a qualification, not necessarily a degree, from an American university. The legal team thought, this sounds a bit odd. So they went home that evening, and this is a true story, the QC acquired the same qualification for his dog by paying the fee. And interestingly, the dog got a higher mark than the man who claimed to have secured it. So this is all chapter and verse in law reports. So my point, sorry for having wandered miles off, is that you can get people, and the court can be misled by so-called experts. You can get witnesses. And we've just had in our jurisdiction the most fabulous example of justice, which is the post office sub-postmasters. And some of these people were convicted of crime. Some were sent to prison. And it all turned out that they'd been accused of fraud, taking money from the post office, sub-post offices, which they ran. It all turned out to be down to a massive technological cock-up. And only now has it been resolved, in that they have won damages, and the next step is to have lots of convictions set aside. But that, again, that won't bring back the people who committed suicide.
That's right. There was a pregnant lady who was sent to prison.
Yes.
And AI, artificial intelligence, is not going to put the effort in. It was free solicitors that did it.
Yes.
And it was funded by Ethereum, actually.
It was, and they did a fabulous
Absolutely
job.
Absolutely fabulous.
Yeah. And the guy, in fact, the partner at Freeths, I knew him at another firm called DLA. This is the serendipity of law. He was driving in his car and he heard this story, and he thought, you know what, I should have a look at this. And the next thing, they win. In practice, again, a lesson learned is that somebody comes to see you, and the first ever case I had reported, I don't pretend I had many, was a lady called Miss Woodward, and she slipped over an ice and snow going into work at a factory in Coventry. It ended up in the law reports about, you know, duty to provide a safe place of work, safe means of access to place of work. But I sat down with her and took her story down, never realising that one day we'd end up in the High Court, the Court of Appeal, the House of Lords, now the Supreme Court. You never know. And that's why you've got to take every case seriously, because that might just be the one.
My favourite TV lawyer was Petrocelli, and the reason I became a solicitor. Who's your legal hero, your fictional movie and TV lawyer?
Right, well, the one that got me determined that I loved law was so long ago, and that was Raymond Burr playing Perry Mason. Yes, long, long, long ago.
Fabulous.
Yep. The single lawyer in a movie by a mile was Tom Hagen, who is a consigliere to The Godfather. And that moment when the corrupt policeman has beaten up, has smashed Michael Corleone's jaw outside the hospital. And at that moment, Tom Hagen turns up and says, you've got to let these private agents here are authorised to protect my client. And if you don't allow them entry, you'll be before a judge in the morning to explain yourself. And that moment when Tom Hagen uses the law to send off an intended assassin and McCluskey has to give way and says, get them out of here. Tom Hagen doing his bit. I thought that was a brilliant piece of... I mean, The Godfather is a masterpiece, and that creation was as a lawyer should be.
Professor Regan, please tell us, what is your favourite legal anecdote? And this is the ITT Hope, which stands for Innovation in Technology and Transport. Now, we've talked a lot about technology and, you know, a lot about innovation. Is it possible that you could squeeze a legal anecdote in that might, just for the benefit of the ITT listeners, squeeze in a commercial vehicle?
Right. Two stories. Now, the first one is a story against me, so you'll all love this. These stories are dead true. So I was staying at the Hotel Devane in Brighton, and I'd organised a taxi to take me up to the train station, which is really at the top of a very big hill in Brighton. So I come out, get in the taxi, and the taxi driver is an incredibly jolly African man, really a big, bright, beamy smile anyway. And he said to me, what do you do? And I said, I'm a lawyer. And he said, but what do you really do? I thought, right, I'm going to let him have this. So I said, well, I advise the government on law reform. I work with senior judges, again, on law reform. Sometimes I'll help other lawyers with problems. I talk to lawyers, or I, you know, do broadcasts, I write articles. I've done television programs, I've done documentaries, like a program called Dispatches for Channel 4. And he said, that's amazing. He said, that's amazing. Then he paused and he said, you look so simple. Anyway, and my favourite, and this is from the New Law Journal, again, not made up, something that appeared in the New Law Journal a few years ago, and you can find it. And it was written by a claims handler working for a school bus transport company. And the letter read as follows. We acknowledge receipt of your letter of the 10th inst claiming compensation for injuries to your daughter Jane on the school bus that morning. Jane is well known to our drivers. She's a pesky little nuisance and will never do what she's told. If she wouldn't sit down when told to, it serves her right that she fell and got hurt. So we respectfully suggest that you F off. Yours faithfully.
I wonder how you get away with that in today's climate, but what's the best piece of advice that someone has given you, and did you take it?
Never sell yourself cheap. And I did take it. Because what I've found, and this, whatever you do, if you go in too low, then, of course, what will happen is that, and you're any good, of course, they'll want you back. And then if you try to charge anyone, they say, well, you did last time with this. So don't sell yourself cheap. You get what you pay for. That's a very important point of principle. I think so. I always think the best of people, but if they cross me, then, sorry, they're dead. Because I'm an incredibly believer in loyalty. To such an extent, this sounds remote, but my hairdresser, who worked in London, she left to have children. And then 4 years later, I discovered that she'd opened 20 minutes out of London in a place called St. Albans. And I now go to St. Albans to get my hair cut. Because Sophie, I trust her with my life and my hair. And I've got hair, as has Ian, great hair. I think loyalty is incredibly, incredibly important, and people respect loyalty.
I heard someone say that loyalty is royalty, and I think that's
That's good.
It's a good line, though.
Yeah, it is.
That's a gift to you, that, actually.
It is. Thank you. It is. And the other one is always assume the best of people and the highest people. So it was on a television programme, and this woman described how, you know, she regularly flew across the channel, and this man said, "Are you a hostess?" She said, "No, I'm a British Airways pilot." And always assume that people are at the top of the game and not the bottom of the game, because and they can say, well, actually no, to demean her, and that was sort of undermining, to assume that she was not a person of great responsibility was just really coming at it in the wrong direction. I do lots, although obviously not this year, I do zillions of talks, and I have minders and all these people, and always be lovely to them, they're lovely to you, but the people who are just in the background, you look after them, and you know what, they look after you. And I think I always go ahead of my, I say hello to every one of them, and how are they, and it's not glib, it's not, you know, how are you, I don't even listen to the answer, I genuinely do that. And we've been to a few restaurants, and I get, with humility, I get treated. Sean Jones QC will tell you this. He said, who's the most famous person you ever sat next to in a restaurant? And he said, Dominic Regan. And the reason is because where any restaurant I go to, I'm civil and I say please and thank you. And you know what? There are so many idiots out there who are rude, and you get tenfold payback. If you're nice to people, they are nice to you. And that's from the heart.
I absolutely can see that's from the heart, Dominic. And we're sat in the building of the Society of Engineers, and it was a guy, Peter Chidley, who was a member of the IRT, the Institute of Road Transport Engineers. And we did a talk for him once, and I always remember this. He said, it's a great line, and I teach my kids this, politeness costs nothing, buys everything.
That's a great one again. Yeah. It's just to help people. I mean, I've lost count of the number of times I've carried buggies up staircases for, you know, stations and that. I was in Paris once with my boys. I've got three boys. I've also got three girls. And they saw somebody, a young mother, a black woman, with an overburdened buggy, and they just grabbed it and carried it up the stairs. And, you know, I just thought, excellent. This is what it's all about. Do good. Hold doors open for people. As you say, it costs nothing. And, you know, the impression, and again, you've never seen these people again, but just doing good and helping people. How wonderful.
If you could write a letter to your 12-year-old self, what would you say?
It's going to be all right. You feel sort of quite anxious and unknowing, and just simple sort of reassurance. That's what people want.
I think that's a really good answer. And so my kids say to me, literally just coming out of COVID, they say, you'll be written on your gravestone, it'll be fine.
It'll be fine. That's a good line.
Fine.
Yeah, it's good.
Oh, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
Now, they also say it in a very cutting way, because if I'm doing a DIY job and I won't do it properly, I'll just it'll be fine. Yeah. So apparently that is the testament to me, it'll be fine.
Yeah, well, that's me as well. I hate DIY.
Yeah,
my
wife's
my great thing is pay people who know what they're doing to do it. Honestly, you know, well, people pay me, and likewise, you know what? You pay a good doctor or a good optician or, you know, a good anybody, a good mechanic, anything. But you know what? They're the experts. And, yeah. And that makes the world go round.
Who's been influential to you in your life?
I mentioned in our previous conversation a guy called Phil King, who was at Thompson's. And he was amazing because he'd started as, well, what was called a managing clerk, i.e. an unqualified assistant. And he worked his way up. And it got to the point, and I was in the room when this happened, when QCs like Peter Weitzman QC would ring Phil up for advice on cases. And he went on and he qualified and became a partner. And he was my absolute hero and role model. One of his lessons, again, from litigation, if ever you win anything, just take it very quietly. Don't boast, don't crow, because one day the boot will be on the other foot. So you we had a good day, whatever it was. But don't get cocky. That rubs people up the wrong way. Just do good.
If you could run the country for a year, what would you tackle first?
At the moment, online gambling, which I think is a monstrous thing, and it causes so much grief. I do.
Do you have a favourite quote or reference point?
It's not necessarily about me. There's a wonderful line from Oliver Goldsmith. It's about somebody who's clever. All the people are listening to him give a talk, and he says, "And still they gazed, and still the wonder grew that one small head could carry all he knew." I thought I rather like that. Yeah.
Then that's fabulous.
Yeah, it is. Right. The Vicar of Wakefield, by the way, I think that quotation is from.
Is that right?
Yeah, Vicar of Wakefield. "And still they gazed, and still the wonder grew that one small head could carry all he knew."
Are you a fan of psychometric testing interviews? And where on the scale do you trust people? Because on a scale of 1 to 5, people you meet, are you trusting of them or not trusting? 1 is not trusting, and 5 is you're very trusting.
I think I'll probably be a 4, in that, as I think I mentioned earlier, I always start off assuming that people are decent and honourable. And if my antennae suggest that that's not so, then woomph, they're a 1. Because most people are good people. Then there are some malevolent individuals, and I've come across them over the years, and you know, people with sharp elbows, and they just want to steal an advantage, steal a march. But broadly, people are good. That's been my experience.
Yeah, I'm a 4 as well.
And yeah, okay.
I'm a 4, and that question is, it's funny, I always call him James Backhouse. He's the only James I know. If I did know any other Jameses, they would be secondary to the James. Yeah. I always call him James Backhouse.
Yeah.
And it was his question, because he was talking to someone, a senior regulator, shall we say, a judicial appointed regulator, and that person said that they started off as a 1. And we're like, James is like, my goodness, I'm the opposite. I'm like, like you, and he's like me, you and me, in that you go in as a 4 and you trust people.
Sure.
But once you cross that line, it's game over.
Yeah, the problem with starting with a 1 is that it's very hard to move off from that. And also, perhaps more pertinently, will you not alienate the individual if you've got this sort of guarded and that sort of slant-eyed look at them, as if you're counting your fingers? That is not a good thing. So I think in a way it becomes then self-fulfilling, that you're never going to get on, you're never going to have that sort of warmth, because you have almost written them off, and you're going to give off bad vibes because you are so cautious and defensive.
I agree. What's that line, sort of, it's best to be deceived by a friend than to distrust a friend.
Wow.
I think that's really profound.
That is profound.
It's all about inside your heart, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which idea got away from you?
Well, as you mentioned, I've done legal talking for a long time. Because I had a large young family, I could never take the gamble, because I was educating them all, of sort of literally sort of just going off totally in business and on my own. And arguably, I could have made an awful lot of money doing that. But my concern was a family. I wanted them all to be fed and educated and have that certainty. So to that extent, if I'd been, I hate the word entrepreneurial, but if I'd been more of a gambler, I could have made an awful lot more. But equally, you know what, who knows, hindsight is the greatest gift on earth, and it's useless.
It is.
Can't undo the past.
Yeah, general hindsight never won any wars. How many children do you have, Dominic?
I have 3 girls and 3 boys.
Oh, wow. I didn't know. Are any lawyers?
One, Isabel, is a lawyer. Yeah.
What does she practice? But
they're all good. So she qualified at City Firm Allen and Overy. She had a lovely time. And indeed, got the dream posting of 6 months in Paris, in a very good Paris flat. And whereas in London, people work all hours, because of France and French labour law, that somebody would come around at 6 o'clock and throw them out of the offices and make them stop work and make them go home to comply with French law on working time.
Do you think culturally they're just better than us, the French?
I love the French. I do. And Italians too. I do. But I think the French have got a lot going for them, and they look after themselves, and they're elegant, and you don't need a lot of money, you know, to wash your hair and things like that, but just they look after themselves. I think that's a really important detail. Yeah? I hate people who look slovenly.
It's funny, I hear about things that your pet hates.
Yeah.
I can't stand people walking down the street eating.
Yeah.
You know, like walking down the street. That's disgusting.
It's barbaric.
It is. And I've probably done it myself on a stag do or something.
It's just there's a time and a place, isn't there?
And I'm obsessed about table manners as well with my kids. If they just try eating American style with just a fork, I'm like, pick up that knife. My kids go mad.
I'm in a vast minority here, but I don't like people who are covered in tattoos. I just think it's disfiguring. And it may be horribly cool now, but in 1, 3, 5 years, no.
What would your perfect Sunday look like?
Right, well, I love the newspapers every day of the week, so having the papers.
Physical paper or online?
Oh, physical paper, yeah. In Bath, which is where I am based, there's an amazing Sicilian cafe and Rosario's. I like going there and having a coffee, and he has the freshest, I mean, the orange juice is liberated from the orange before your eyes, and just that. In Paris, I love going to have breakfast at somewhere like the Domago, and you sit on the pavement outside and again have a coffee, juice, croissant. I mean, that sort of thing, that's just lovely. And then wandering around. There was a time I used to love lunch, but I can't really cope with lunch anymore. I love eating in the evening, and so going out in the evening, so wandering around and going looking at art galleries. I love bookshops and things as well. I love shops, period. Abroad, I love going into supermarkets and pharmacies because they have all these things that you don't see in England. I just love that variety, and of course wine shops as well, so all that sort of territory. And then evening, going out for Woody Allen, his favourite line, it was, "Where shall we go out for dinner tonight?" And I just think that's just the loveliest line. And I think he spent 18 months in London filming intermittently, and he had dinner out every single night for 18 months, and I could cope with that.
This is the line that I've used throughout COVID. This podcast's not about COVID, and it's a line that I had pre-COVID, but it's really come into its own. And it's Kurt Vonnegut, you know, the American philosopher who was, I think he was in Dresden as a POW when it was bombed. And so he literally came out of he managed to survive. And he said, and it's his favourite quote, I'm going to read it here so I get it right. And I say this all the time to people. "I urge you to please notice when you are happy and exclaim or murmur or think at some point, if this isn't nice, I don't know what is."
Aww.
And I think, and that line, and yeah. I'll be sat in the gardens here, butterfly. Yeah. And I'll say to the kids, "If this isn't nice, I don't know what is."
Garrison Keillor, a great American writer, "Forgive us this, good Lord, if we don't appreciate the life we have." And yeah, it's a simple little. I mean, it may sound like a bit folksy, homily-like, but you know what? It's there.
Oh yeah, I can live my life as a fridge magnet, and it keeps me going.
Yeah.
Okay, what keeps you up at night?
Nothing. I love sleep. I love my sleep. God, I love sleep. It sounds pathetic, but even when I was a teenager, you know what? Broadly, I like to go to bed about 10, and I like to read. I can easily do 10 hours sleep. I love sleep.
It's funny you'd say that, because I asked this question, and it takes every night, I mean through COVID, I mean through the entirety of my life, to get to sleep, it takes me between 60 and 90 seconds.
Excellent.
And I just put my head on the pillow and I go to sleep. And people talk about insomnia. And I try to sympathise with and I try to understand what they're saying. My wife, whatever. But what do you mean? Why don't you just go to sleep?
It's like, the most natural thing in the world.
I was awake for 120 seconds, I'd be like, What's going on?
I wake up in the morning thinking, oh, God, I can't. Great, I'll have a good sleep tonight.
It matters not what's going on anywhere.
And sleep is so. I mean, these people who boast about going without sleep are
crazy.
Well, I mean, I think there is scientific material say that if you're sleep deprived, you're the equivalent of over the limit. Because if you've been drinking, if I ever have a disturbed night, it's because of a car alarm or some hotel ventilation's blowing up at 4 a.m. or something like that. Thank you, Hilton. Then, you know, I'm gaga the next morning. Bouncing. And, you know, I can't remember whether I brushed my teeth. And a good sleep is just so restorative.
You talk about reading. What are you reading at the moment, and what's your favourite book?
There are certain books I keep on coming back to. There's a book of short stories by Garrison Keillor called Leaving Home, which I know every word of, and I read them, and some of the stories still bring tears to my eyes. As a teenager, he won a New Yorker prize of then about $15,000 or $20,000 for a short story he'd written. That book, Leaving Home, is the stories are astonishing. I love travel writing. Ian knows I won't fly. I don't enjoy flying, but I love trains. I know my way around the Eurostar, absolutely whizzing backwards and forwards to Paris. Ordinarily, I'd do it like, what, 5-6 times a year. In fact, the father of Louis Theroux, Paul Theroux, is a magnificent travel writer, and his breakthrough book was called The Great Railway Bazaar, and he went off on this journey starting on the 19th of September 1973, and he travelled all the way from London through Europe, India, Japan, and round back through Russia to England, and that is just an amazing piece of travel literature. At the latter part of his journey, he gets on this train in the Japanese end of Russia, and it's an old Russian train. And it's this most amazing sensation, because he's travelled, 10 weeks by train. And it's the most comfortable train. And it's like, he describes it as like an old Victorian English pub. And it's got deep carpet, and it's got feather pillows and a proper armchair. And he describes how he puts his pipe down and his glass, his little bottle of vodka. And it's just so snug. And you think, it's dark, it's cold, you're warm, you've got this space, you've got this... That really just hits the spot. Lovely, lovely journey. Yeah, that's a good book. As is The Godfather.
The book's good. It's different. Yeah. I always say that the book is always better than the film, but actually the film is better than the book. It's the exception that proves the rule.
It is. You can buy online, and it's published by Regan, of all things, American publisher, The Godfather Notebooks, because what Francis Coppola did, he bought the book and he cut every page out. Obviously, he had to buy two copies, and he taped each page of the book to a page in this big notebook and then annotated it and all of his thoughts. All that, he says, this doesn't work. But you read the annotation and you see it come through in the movie. It's brilliant. I've got the shooting scripts of The Godfather 1 and 2.
I can act The Godfather. It's marvellous. Who's your favourite character? Tom Hagen.
Well, I love Michael. I love Tom Hagen. I felt very sorry for Luca Brasi, who got killed early on. He was a professional wrestler. And you can look at his build.
Yeah.
Some great lines.
I quite liked Hyman Roth, actually.
In two. Wasn't he the method actor?
Is that Lee Strasberg? Yeah, Lee Strasberg.
Yeah.
I met a client the other day, and he just reminded me of, not so much in looks, but in height and in personality, to Hyman Roth. That kind of... giving across that sort of bumbling old man, but absolutely steel underneath,
knowing everything,
and he was a fantastic client, actually. I often start when I do my seminars. I often say, "We act for the captains of your industry and charlatans with an eye for the main chance." And it's great to see so many of you here today. which I borrowed. I'll be absolutely frank, just for the purposes of transparency and honesty, I borrowed that from Steve Norris, the MP, fellow Evertonian, and he's also a brilliant speaker. And I heard him do that line. I thought, I am borrowing that.
Is he not a man who had an awful lot of girlfriends?
He did. Yeah.
You should read the diaries of Giles Brandreth, which are, whether you like Brandreth or not, the diaries are fabulous.
Are they?
They are.
What's your favourite book ever?
Oh, God, that's so difficult. That's so, so difficult. It's a bit, I wouldn't say it's a favourite, but I have read, and more than once, all 12 volumes of a series called A Dance to the Music of Time, written by a man called Anthony Pohl, spelled Powell, but he pronounced it Pohl. Yeah. And that there's some really interesting characters in there. But interestingly, if you like detective fiction, now the TV series, this is the opposite of The Godfather, the TV series I thought was dire, but the Inspector, the Frost novels, Winter Frost, Hard Frost, Frost at Christmas, are hilarious. They are brilliantly written, and the plotting is sublime, and they're probably my favourite crime writing. So R.D. Wingfield, who did some comedy lines for Carry On films and things like that, but the stories are absolutely excellent, starting with one called A Touch of Frost, Really intelligent stories, I promise you.
And back into my reading, which is, I've always read, and I read a lot, and I couldn't really read. Bizarrely, we had this lockdown, and I couldn't read, whether it was some kind of, not anxiety, but I couldn't focus.
Yeah.
But I'm now back to my reading. I'm reading
what
two
are you reading? Books.
You'll love this, but I don't know whether you... I like India. I'm reading The Anarchy by William Dalrymple.
Okay, I know of Dalrymple. I don't know anything about
or
India.
He's talking about the rise of the East India Company.
Right.
That is fabulous. And so he goes from how the East India Company is one of the very first limited companies, started in 1600 in Elizabethan times, when England was just pirates. We were a nothing country.
Yeah.
And we contributed nothing to the world's GDP. And India was contributing 35% of the world's GDP. And then it's how Robert Clive of India, how this company took over India.
Yep.
At its height, the East India Company never had more than 2,000 white English employees in India.
Wow.
And by brutality, treachery, clever politics, negotiations, playing the two sides off against the middle, the East India Company took control of India. And then eventually they were then bailed out by the British government, and the British government got hold of India, which is fabulous. And then I'm also reading, I love Robert Harris. Do you like Robert Harris?
Oh, I know Robert Harris. Yes.
Fabulous.
I thought Fatherland was a genius book. The first one of SS thing. Yeah.
And An Officer and a Spy was good.
Right. So since we're in London, the other great thing, of course, are Pevsner's Architectural Guides to London. And especially around here, I showed something interesting a minute's walk from here. But he did walk the streets, noting interesting buildings, architectural features. And, you know, you walk down a street and miss 100 details. There are walks in Pevsner, and I cannot recommend enough doing a Pevsner walk. And the Volume 1, City of London, and it's got the temple and all of that, is just astonishing.
I love Pevsner's guys.
Yeah.
Do you think we were born under the same star or something?
Well, I think we've got a lot of common ground, and a lot of people have never heard of Pevsner. I love detail. He says, look at this, look at that, you know, appreciate this this particular feature. Sorry.
What does luxury mean to you, Dominic?
Luxury means not worrying about money, I suppose, in one sense. Luxury means a good hotel, a good meal, a good restaurant, something that makes one feel pampered. That's luxury.
What food have you never eaten but would really like to try?
Oh, God. On the contrary, I've eaten things that I detest. Like, I hate oysters, foie gras, truffle. Makes me gag, even though it's one of the most expensive things you could ever find on a restaurant menu. So I don't have unfulfilled ambition on that front.
What TV show character would be most fun to change places with for a week?
Oh, now you're talking. Lockdown, I discovered a TV programme that I've never seen before called Pointless. And, you know, I really enjoy that. I enjoy quizzes, you see, and knowledge and stuff.
Yeah.
So I quite like Richard Armstrong's position on that.
What's the craziest conversation you've ever overheard?
I was in Harrods once, having a cup of tea, and there's a Japanese man with a moustache and a woman, a youngish couple, and the waiter kept on referring to them as ladies. What are you having? Ladies. And that was... I just looked at them. I don't know what was going on. And that really... That's true. That threw me. That's absolutely, as ever, a bizarre example, I know, but gospel. Yeah?
Where is your go-to restaurant?
My favourite of all time was... It still exists, but it's not what it was. A place called Bibendum, which is on the first floor of the Michelin building on the Fulham Road. And it opened in November 1987. And I went there the week it opened. And I went there ever since. I've had birthdays there. My children have had birthdays there. Then latterly, the recently deceased Sir Terence Conran decided to change the whole format and brought in some outside chef and just got rid of the lovely staff and, to my mind, ruined it. But that's my favourite restaurant. I had my own table number 4, and the staff were brilliant, and they'd often give me a glass of champagne when I arrived, and all was well with the world.
Is that the Michael Caine one?
No. I've seen the actor Michael Caine. He was at table one when I was at table
is that
four.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. In Babette. Well, because he's got a flat in a place called Chelsea Harbour, which is not far away from there. I've seen lots of famous people. But yeah, Bibendum. And it was a lovely room, great sort of French menu, lovely choice, reasonable prices, excellent wine list. The staff were just amazing. They were like family.
Michael Caine's probably sat at home now telling a story to someone. I was in Bibendum, and you'll never believe it. Dominic Regan was on table four.
We've had Jerry Hall at the next table. I was having dinner at a hotel called the Goring, which is quite close to Buckingham Palace. And at the next table, over for their mother's funeral, were the Thatcher children. But I had a better table than the Thatchers.
You mentioned earlier on about being nice to people.
Yeah.
I met someone, a guy who works at Arriva Buses. I don't know, he's a transport manager, but he used to be in the military in years gone by. And so his job was guarding the plane that flew politicians around the world.
Yes.
And so I said, well, go on, tell me some more. Yeah, tell me, he said. And
who's
so,
nice, who's not?
Yeah, you're correct. That's exactly right.
That's exactly it.
And so he would not have a bad word said about Mrs. Thatcher.
No.
He said, on this plane, the plane would land, and so his job was to guard the plane as it was on the tarmac. And you would witness Mrs. Thatcher in action at a pomp when she was Prime Minister. And he said she was absolutely merciless with foreign politicians, absolutely ruthless with her own cabinet and politicians and people of her level. You would not find a kinder person to people below her.
Yeah, he said, absolutely.
Absolutely. She never talked down to anybody. She was very considerate. There was a time where the waitress dropped something and she wouldn't allow the waitress to pick it up and she mopped it up herself.
Yeah, that story appears in the Giles Brandreth
Is that right?
Diaries. Yes, absolutely. That she was just amazingly grounded.
And he was saying,
and she'd cook. She'd rustle up the fish fingers and things like that.
They were all invited.
Yeah.
And at the end of the journey, wherever the journey was, they would then get a handwritten note from her to, I forgot his name. To whatever your name is. thank you for looking after me on this journey. Yeah. And then once a year, they would then be invited to number 10, and she would cook for them. He would not have a bad word said about
my
him.
Point about be good to little people.
And he said John Major, man of the people, rubbish, absolutely completely ignored you.
Really? That's a revelation.
It was a revelation. I like Mr. Thatcher, Mr. Major. Digressing here, but this is my stock line here. I'll give you this as a gift to
you. Too. I need a few gifts.
This is a stock. You know, if you're at an event and someone calls upon you to speak and you're not expecting it, you probably could carry it off. But apparently, I think this is a true story, they were at some foreign embassy. Mrs. Thatcher had given her speech. And so whoever the ambassador was, he said, against protocol, said, oh, Mr. Thatcher's here, Dennis is here, let's ask him to say a few words. So
Dennis would have been well-oiled, I'd imagine.
So Dennis Thatcher stood up and said, I don't know why I'm giving him a Lancashire accent, because so Dennis, if it works for the purpose, Dennis Thatcher stood up and said, I'd like to quote Julius Caesar as he entered Cleopatra's bedchamber. I haven't come to talk. and then he promptly sat down.
lovely.
Right, we haven't talked wine. And of all the people we'll get going to, but of all the people not to talk wine with, tell me which is your favourite wine.
There's a question and a half. I love some Châteauneuf made by a producer called Beaucastel. And I had my first bottle of it at the Ritz in about 1988, 89 perhaps. But it is most wonderful wine. I love white Burgundy, which is a Chardonnay, of course. And so Meursault, Pouligny-Monrache. A lot of people, a great giveaway. If ever, I mean, because some wine people can be a bit snooty. One way of saying in terms I know myself, no nonsense, is looking at the list, say, oh, I see you've got some interesting Pulni Monrache here. The point is that it looks like it might be, and a lot of English people do say Montrachet, and it's not, it's Monrache. And if you so just drop that in, even though you're not even looking at white wine or whatever, say, oh, this is an interesting Pulni Monrache, then it shows you know your stuff. And I tell you, they immediately, they change their attitude. The wine, I think it's changed an awful lot. A good sommelier will give you advice. They won't necessarily try and get you to buy something more expensive. In fact, a really good sommelier in my book, you say, well, you know, what's interesting? And they'll point at something that is perhaps, they might say, well, you know, what are you looking to spend? And don't be shy. These people aren't earning as much money as you, probably, if you're a lawyer. So, you know, don't be ashamed of saying, oh, I don't want to spend more than X pounds. But, you know, a good, in my book, a good sommelier, or somme, as they're called in the trade, where's the somme? Yeah, again, it shows you, you know, one of the cognoscenti, say, can I have a word with the somme, please? Is that they will look at something and say, you know what? This comes from Tasmania, which, by the way, is a source of brilliant wine. Got a really good climate, white and red, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay. It's very easy to point to something, you know, it's lazy to point to something that's incredibly eye-wateringly expensive. But I think it's really interesting to find something that's off-piste, yeah? So, and I love champagne. I always say, I don't believe in big labels. The best champagne comes from smaller producers. There is a French producer called Runard, and the Blanc de Blanc, which is Blanc, is just pure Chardonnay grape. That is the most beautiful glass of champagne. Big names are very, you're paying for an awful lot of marketing, and you know what? And there have been times, absolutely, when I felt so under the weather. I think, you know, will I even be able to get up in the morning? A glass of champagne in the evening, and you know what? It brings one back to life. Yeah.
So we've discussed with Dominic his views on the legal profession. What you don't know, listeners, is that Dominic is also the wine critic for the Council magazine, and I am of the view that that is his most famous achievement in his eyes.
Yeah.
But what I would like to say is that if champagne wanted a pick-me-up, it would drink Professor Dominic Regan. Dominic, thank you for being on the Back View.
I've loved every second. Thank you, Ian.